or their bathroom's a mess, or whatever. It went beyond the food. We got kinky, and we had fun, says Franz. Vranian describes the distinctly Bay Area sensibility of the cooking community. I don't know how to talk about it. It was just family. It was an extended family, and it's what you did. We didn't even call each other chefs. Anywhere that I worked, but especially at Santa Fe Bar and Grill, if you were at a certain level, you went by initials JT, SV, MF. Otherwise, it was just the first name. And if East Coast guys came in the kitchen for events and they were all saying, Chef, we would all go, Oh, we chef, we. Really sarcastic. And to this day, the only person it would be meaningful to have recognize me as a chef and call me chef would be Jeremiah, frankly. I don't recall any of us thinking that this was a career or thinking it was a job. It was more of a lifestyle, says Vranian. I never thought I was going to have my own restaurant. I never thought anything like that. It was my lifestyle. I wanted to be in a place where the food and the wine and the people you were with reflected what you do outside of it. I wanted to eat the food there that I would eat at home and vice versa. And it had to be that. And so somehow you had to find a way, whoever that leader was. And to me, I was specifically thinking Jeremiah, who could round up all these people that had like values, although I don't think it was intentional. I think it just sort of happened.
We weren't going into kitchens of established restaurants. We were the people that set up the kitchens.
Another defining characteristic of the industry in the Bay Area at this transitional time was that it was, uniquely among Western culinary hubs, not just welcoming to women in a professional kitchen, but, with the significant exception of Tower, largely dominated by women chefs and restaurateurs. Waters was, of course, the most powerful of them all. Many of the women who followed her worked for a time at Chez Panisse, either at the inception of their careers or midstream. Joyce Goldstein of the Mediterranean restaurant Square One opened in May 1984, just weeks before Stars debuted. Deborah Madison of the vegetarian Greens opened in 1979. And the late Judy Rogers of the enduring local classic Zuni Cafe, where she took over the kitchen in 1987. To name just three. Chez Panisse also launched the careers of several male chefs, including Paul Bertoli, Christopher Lee, and David Tanis, among many others. Beyond Chez Panisse alumni, there were Nancy Oakes of L'Avenue, launched in 1988, and then Boulevard in 1993. Patricia Unterman of Hay Street Grill, opened in San Francisco's Performing Arts District in 1979, and before that of Berkeley's Beggar's Banquet, which she purchased and took over with no real professional experience. And Napa Valley pioneer Cindy Paulson of Mustard's Grill, opened in 1983, and other restaurants, including San Francisco's Fog City Diner, opened in 1985.
Females did dominate the Bay Area for many, many, many years, says Goldstein,
who taught cooking classes for close to two decades, first in her home starting in 1966, and then in her own school, before discovering the professional kitchen at age 46 at Chez Panisse.
They don't dominate anymore. Not so much. It used to be way more. At that time, women ran the Bay Area.
Why were San Francisco area kitchens so open to women, when in virtually all other cities they were centers for sanctioned sexism and harassment?
Because San Francisco is the least traditional place in the country, says Unterman,
who, in addition to being a chef and restaurateur, was the San Francisco Chronicle's food critic for 15 years.
The strictures of society are the loosest here. There was the whole self-discovery slash gay movement. There are no barriers here. And we're at the end of the continent here, the Wild West. We've also been a boom-and-bust society up here, of the gold rush and whatnot. Anything is possible, and nothing holds you back.
Gail Peary, who with partner John Clark was co-chef de cuisine at Judy Rogers' kitchen at Zuni Cafe, and today co-owns Foreign Cinema Restaurant with him, echoes the sentiment.
We're new. We're like 200 years old in 1970. New York is like 400 years old. Plus the size, the dynamics, the hierarchy of the city, the age of it. I do think it was old school in the 70s and 80s, New York. Trying to apprentice in a hotel, corporate, male-driven. I'm sure women all had a problem. Out here was the fucking Wild West. Chez Panisse, I mean, opened up in a house. The West Coast is just not as old as New York, and we had less constraints. It was just very free and hippie-ish here. It really was. We were a younger society. There was real estate and space and less people. And in New York, it's older. There's more people. There's more structure. And we just didn't have it out here. The sky was the limit. The sky.
Unterman applies the same logic to why it was so easy for inexperienced American cooks, both men and women, to find their way into kitchens in San Francisco in the first place.
Because we created them. We weren't going into kitchens of established restaurants. We were the people that set up the kitchens. So, of course, there was no barrier. No one had even worked in a restaurant. For me, it was just starting at such a basic level, and being fearless and jumping in, and learning step by step how to do it.
A philosophical and practical distinction between chefs in New York City and Northern California, one which facilitated the introduction of so many untrained cooks into the Bay Area's culinary workforce, was the relative emphasis on sublime, local product, Northern California, over transformative ambition and technique, New York, or vice versa. Unterman says that for her, dining in New York City in the 1980s
seemed like it was in another age, different. They were too far away from their ingredients. The food got its energy here from the ingredients. And there, the product was really far from what you ended up getting. Everything was manipulated, overly cooked. Nobody did have technique out there. But we had the advantage of having really tasty raw materials. And so you really didn't have to do so much to it to make it taste really good, because the stuff itself was so delicious. You add a little good butter and a great just-picked vegetable. Oh, my God. I don't care what you do to the damn thing, it can't be surpassed with cooking. So that's the difference. We were the place where all the good stuff was. You went to New York and you just felt like, well, it's very French. But somehow in France you felt much closer to the ingredient.
Whether or not this speaks to an inherent difference between men and women chefs is debatable. But many key players believe it does.
When men get food, they want to transform it into something else, says Goldstein. We don't want to transform it. We want to bring it up, and the guys want to take it and change it. That's just a different headset. Now, I also want to say that I never wanted to have an all-female kitchen. The hormone level is insane. There's too much, are you all right? It makes you crazy. And you don't want to have an all-male kitchen either, because there is all the competition. Chop, chop. So you want to have this balance of female energy in the kitchen and male energy. It's a good thing to have. The men who end up working for women chefs turn out to be better chefs later on, because they've had two different approaches in their learning career. And also because they've been nurtured by the woman chef. So that maybe when they go to open their own restaurant, they're not throwing pans at people and calling them motherfucker and screaming at them and humiliating them in public.
Echoes Waters herself.
I think you need both points of view. They complement each other. When the restaurant becomes too male-oriented, I want more women in the restaurant, front and back of the house. I think there's a very important balance that needs to be maintained. I just think that men think about food differently, and women are, I mean, they have it in them. This is just part of their genes. They're into the nurture play. Men need to be creative, to be career-oriented, to be recognized, to be all of that. But that comes from the culture that pushes on that, demands that of men. I think of myself as a more masculine woman. And I think of a lot of men that I work with as feminine men. And I think it's a beautiful thing to strive for, that we can meet in that place and understand each other.
Another byproduct of the unique gender dynamics of San Francisco kitchens, which admittedly flirt with the stereotypical, was that they were, on the whole, collaborative and communal.
It was, "We're all in it together," says Goldstein. "We all want to make it, but we all want to help each other out. Not, fuck you, this is mine." I think that made us democratic in every way, not just towards who dined in the restaurants, but also how we ran our business.
It sounds romanticized, but San Francisco had a sort of mystical pull on people in those days, and not just because of its politics. Native New Yorker Goldstein moved there after spending time in Italy for apolitical reasons.
"We came back from living in Europe and traveling around the Mediterranean, and I looked at New York and I said, 'This city is so ugly, I can't live here. I've been living in the Mediterranean, and I need to see light and water and the sky and trees.' My former husband had worked in San Francisco for a summer, and he said, 'The only city in the country that looks like the Mediterranean is San Francisco.' We packed up everything we owned in our car and we drove across the country. I'd never been, and we didn't know a soul."
Dominique Crenn, who now presides over her own 2-Michelin-star Atelier Crenn, first came to San Francisco years later in search of a less chauvinistic professional community than the one back home, and ended up working for Tower at Starz. She experienced an epiphany the moment she arrived.
"I was still in the airport, and I felt something," she says. "I don't know what it was. I just felt like I was home." "We all love it here," says Goldstein,
more than half a century later.
"That's why we're here."
Sue Conley and Peg Smith, partners in Cowgirl Creamery, were part of the Northern California cooking community at the time. Conley as a cook for Bambi McDonald at Hotel Obrero in Chinatown, and then 4th Street Grill in Berkeley under Paul Bertoli. And Smith as a cook and then manager of the Chez Panisse Café Kitchen. And they echo Goldstein's point.
"It was very collaborative back then," says Smith,
who describes how cooks from different restaurants freely compared notes on dishes and preparations.
"You talk to cooks. Deborah Madison would come and cook with us. Then somebody would go cook at Green's. And the idea was learning and perfecting. It wasn't holding secrets. It wasn't competitive. It was so collaborative. Well, maybe amongst a few people it was competitive. But the cooks were very collaborative." "Zuni was a community of women," says Peary. "When I got to Zuni's, it's 50% males, 50% females. A lot of the males didn't have any authority, but they were lead line cooks who were extremely helpful. So I have that. And then I have also the experience of just all these great women showing up to help Judy. You know, when she went to Africa, she asked Amaryl Schwertner of Boulet Lade to come and be chef. When she went to Italy, she asked Catherine Brandel to come and help. Both Schwertner and Brandel were fellow Chez Panisse alums. It was this great community of women who would come and dovetail. I mean, I don't know anybody that I could call and say, 'Can you be chef for a month while I go to Africa?' No way. No way. Anybody who is a chef is buried in their own shit, so deep they just are trying to figure out how to get through the day, really. That's what we're all trying to do. There were women spilling out of places, and Judy had deep roots with Chez Panisse. And within the Chez Panisse family, there's hundreds of wonderful people. And as bohemians, sometimes you have a month off, and then there's another person who needs a job for a month. So I would say, at Chez Panisse, it's still very bohemian, because they still run it on this bohemian thing where chefs take sabbaticals, and another chef from somewhere else comes in to fill in, or a local person comes in to fill in. I think it still goes on there. Probably not as deep, but that's what it was. You can't even find a cook today, a line cook, let alone to hire a sister visionary to come and run your place while you're gone. Who does that? But that happened. That's what it was. I think Chez Panisse might have set a tone in Berkeley that was contagious, says Conley. That collaborative tone, and that people would leave there, and that was okay, because then they would take the ethics and the vision with them.
Smith feels that this sentiment was extended even to outsiders.
I remember Wolfgang Puck coming up, and it was before he opened Spaga. I remember him sitting in the booths. He came and looked at how we did the pizzas and asked a lot of questions. It wasn't, "Sorry, we can't tell you that. This is classified information." It's just pizza. Everybody thought, this is food. This is not a life or death situation that we're doing here. We're just trying to make things as good as they possibly can be. It's like, carry the message out to the world. I really think it was an offspring of the feeling of the protest, the free speech movement.
Christopher Lee, who began working at Chez Panisse in 1986, eventually becoming co-chef with David Tanis, believes that Waters taught a way to live, a way to treat people, a way to be in the kitchen. She was one of the people who also taught us not to shout and throw things in the kitchen. Much of this wasn't stated explicitly, says Lee, but rather in a way that a dog pack might teach its young, where you're very specific. You get a correction, and that's it. But mainly it's sorted by your own observation. You see, first of all, it's a kitchen at that time run by women, a significant number of women on the staff, so that took some of the brutality out of it. Now, I'm not saying that there are no brutal female chefs, there certainly are. It was a different tone, and I think the Bay Area is sort of 15 or 20 years ahead of New York in that respect. Jesse Cool, chef and owner of Menlo Park's Flea Street Cafe since 1981, and before that of Late for the Train, and a pioneer in organic practices, so associated the profession with abhorrent male behavior that,
"I didn't like the word chef, because I thought chefs were assholes. We used to struggle with what to put on my card," says Cool. "Cooker person?" They said, "You can't use cooker person." "How about head cooker person? Lead cooker person?"
Continues Cool.
"Chefs were arrogant and egotistical, and they were rude to women. I cooked at the Almony Hotel 26 or 27 years ago. They would stick me in the corner by the dumpster. I had to bring every ingredient. I had to bring my own tools. They didn't want anything to do with me because I was a woman, untrained, and had purple hair."
Cindy Paulson, whose Mustard Grill helped establish a new era in Napa Valley dining, had had a particularly bruising experience as a cook back home in Minneapolis. A male chef for whom she worked would enter the kitchen and say, "Good morning, cunt," to her every day. If something broke, she might get an angry call from him on her day off, blaming her woman juju.
"I just ignored it because I learned a lot," she says today. "And the minute I sucked everything out of him I could, I left. I wanted to become a chef," says Paulson. "I tasted his food, and I saw how he ran his kitchen, and I knew I wanted to learn from him. So the fact that he was an asshole didn't bother me as much as the fact that he wasn't realizing that I was getting stuff out of him. And it built my confidence, in hindsight."
But the experience also influenced Paulson more than she realized. She became a kitchen screamer the first time she became a chef herself, in Chicago.
"I was really intense and pushed people a lot, because I followed their example, until I realized what I was doing and I went, wow, this isn't how I want to live."
In 1979, when her colleagues Bill Higgins and Bill Upson moved to California to open restaurants, they asked Paulson if she'd relocate and chef for them at a rib restaurant at MacArthur Park. The three went on to open Mustard's Grill in the Napa Valley in 1983. Much as Mary Sue Milliken had, Paulson looked to a very few predecessors as her guiding lights.
"I'll never forget. I came out here with my sister-in-law and my brother. Just before we came out, she sent me a Sunset magazine, and there was a little picture of Sally Schmidt, original chef, and with husband Don Schmidt, co-owner of the French Laundry in Yountville, California, and her herb garden. And I put that on my wall and said, 'See, there's a woman chef.' And there was one small book on woman chefs in France. That's kind of what kept me going."
We're over. This is the beginning of the end. In 1983, Tower and a few of his cooks traveled to the Astor Mansion in Newport, Rhode Island, to cook lunch for 100 journalists, invited there by Ocean Spray's ad agency. It was the kind of thing that was happening at the time, increasingly prominent American chefs being weaponized in service of a product or produce. But the French still ruled. Harris's Guy Savoy had been enlisted to cook dinner, Tower and his crew the lunch. When Savoy's French brigade, already prepping their meal, wouldn't surrender the stoves, Tower marched his crew outside, improvised a grilled feast, even the dessert, cooked by his team, while he mingled about with a glass of champagne, discussing the meal with the writers, who promptly wrote it up for their papers. The lunch opens Tower's California dish, along with the claim that the term California cuisine might never have become known had it not gone down. It's as signature a Tower gesture as the glass of champagne and red-rimmed sunglasses that would become his sartorial trademark. Just as vintage was the emotional roller coaster that ensued when he and his crew boarded their flight back to California. "And when I got on the plane," he says, "I was sitting and my chefs and cooks were sitting in front of me, and Stephen Brannigan looked around to toast with champagne, and he saw me sitting with tears streaming down my face. And he leapt across the back of the chair. 'Oh my God, what's happening?' I said, 'We won. It's a success.' And he said, 'What's the problem?' I said, 'We're over. This is the beginning of the end. This is a very, very dangerous moment. Our lives will never be the same again.'" Spend enough time considering Tower's life, and it's clear that he probably meant what he said on the plane, because his saga is defined by a series of points high and low, which any capable screenwriter will tell you is the secret of good drama, plunging the hero into the depths of desperation, then hoisting him back to an optimistic place, before lowering the boom once again. The man's a human sine curve. And so, Jeremiah comes to California nearly penniless and becomes the chef of Chez Panisse. Jeremiah leaves Chez Panisse and wanders the land as a gun for hire, then opens Stars. Lather, rinse, repeat. On that airplane, things couldn't have been further from over. They were just beginning again. Balboa Cafe and Santa Fe Bar and Grill had been auditions for Tower's dream restaurant, which Moon had finally agreed to finance. Tower envisioned an audaciously gargantuan brasserie, after the fashion of Paris's La Coupole, with influences drawn from a variety of personal heroes and touchstones, such as the life and writings of Lucius Beebe, the columnist credited with coining the term Café Society, and a Slim Aarons photograph of Clark Gable, Van Heflin, Gary Cooper, and Jimmy Stewart, in top coats and tails, at the Hollywood restaurant Romanoff's on New Year's Eve in 1957. Only a former architect or born restaurateur could love the space that Tower found, a rat-infested war horse in a run-down section of town that horrified James Beard, Barbara Kafka, writer James Villas, Stanford Court's Jim Nasica, and actor Danny Kaye, a plugged-in foodie during these years, when he brought them by for a look-see. But where they saw a ruin, he saw the glittering, magnificent brasserie of his dreams, a space he would not just resuscitate, but reanimate. And the location said it all about the democratic restaurant he envisioned, near both the Civic Center, so convenient for office workers, and the War Memorial Opera House, one of the gathering spots for San Francisco society. He had first found the space in 1981, but there were delays and funding gaps and ongoing horn-locking with Moon. But by 1983, construction was moving apace, and word spread of the project. Emily Lichetti, who had cooked in New York City, moved to San Francisco in the spring of 1984, had heard about the impending opening, went to the space. "We moved out around March of 84, and I remember it was completely under construction, but you could see that it was going to be this big, big restaurant, just physically a large space. Because you walk up the stairs and there was a bar that was about 40 feet long, and there's just this huge dining room and the kitchen on the right. And it was going to be an open kitchen, which
Not to say it was the first open kitchen of its kind, but it was one of the first where you could see all the action going on. Jeremiah had a clear vision of what he wanted it to be, says Luchetti. And that was the thing that was so amazing about him. He is extremely creative. You could see his vision of taking all that French traditional, classic, really good stuff, giving it a real twist, both culturally and with California ingredients, and creating something for everybody. But it's such a high level of quality that people will just be blown away by it. I remember being offered a line position there, and I was offered a position at Vivendi, Carlo Midioni's place. And I didn't really have any idea how big Stars was going to be, because you just had this vision of this guy, and it was like, oh, I guess I'll just take the Stars thing.
For the remainder of Stars' build-out, Luchetti was assigned to Santa Fe.
It was much simpler. It was real kind of bar and grill food, but they were doing grilled raclette with French fries and steamed mussels and that kind of thing. And Jeremiah had obviously come from Chez Panisse, so he was really focusing on American ingredients and really taking advantage of what California had to offer in terms of seafood and produce. I started out at the oyster station, opening oysters and making pizzas.
Stars opened on July 4, 1984. In the small world department, like Jams before it, Stars had committed to a pre-opening party before they were fully ready to go, and Franz ended up cooking on a charcoal grill indoors, throwing open the windows for cross-ventilation. There was no opening night supernova for Stars. The restaurant, built for volume, was slow for its scale, and only open for dinner. Late that summer, Andy Fortzheimer, a Harvard-educated cook, arrived in San Francisco, eager to work for Tower. He presented his resume to Franz, who ran it back to the boss, who in turn emerged to confirm Fortzheimer had gone to Harvard and cooked in France. 5 minutes later, Franz hired him, asked him to start 2 days later. Mark looked like what I expected chefs to look like, says Fortzheimer. Jeremiah didn't. To this day, Jeremiah doesn't look like what you expect a chef to look like. He's what you expected the owner of the restaurant to look like, except that he was in whites. But even when he's in whites, he's not really in whites. His pants are light-colored and his shoes are spotless. It's not a kitchen look. Soltner had shit on his aprons. Puck was a mess. Jeremiah never looked like that. Initially, Fortzheimer found himself working the Oyster Bar alongside Clark Frazier, who, with partner Mark Geyer, went on to open Arrow's Restaurant in Ogunquit, Maine. It was a transitional time for the restaurant, which was gathering steam, growing busier. Nobody was sure what to expect, says Fortzheimer, and it was so radically different. The dining room was so different than the Santa Fe dining room. It was bigger and fancier, next to the Opera House. It was just a different thing. And I was very much an outsider in that group, because they mostly knew each other. Business picked up, says Franz, after Carolyn Bates' review in Gourmet magazine. Customers began showing up with the article in hand. Jeremiah and Mark quickly weeded through the level of talent that started showing up at the door, says Fortzheimer. And the volume they did meant that they started getting rid of the weaker Santa Fe bar and grill people very quickly. There was a lot of turnover when I got there. And within 2 months, I was surrounded by people who were all rock stars. And I was very intimidated. They were one of the most talented kitchens. Still the most talented kitchen I've ever worked in by far. The dining room quickly attained Tower's vision, offering whatever one was in the mood for, from a casual bite to a multi-course meal.
We had a huge bar area there, says Luchetti. And one of the amazing things about Stars is people would come in for oysters and a glass of champagne. Or they might come in for a hot dog, because we had a hot dog on the bar menu as well as pizza. So you could come in and spend $30, or you could come in and spend $300. It was really kind of all depending on what you wanted to spend. And you had people that would be going to the opera, and you'd have people going to the ballpark, or coming from the 49ers game, or something like that. Before that, the dressed-up people, the fine dining people, stayed away from the lower classes.
Says Michael Bauer, who moved to San Francisco in the mid-1980s to become restaurant critic of the San Francisco Chronicle.
I think it was Wolfgang who kind of started it. Then you have people like Jeremiah, which I think was the other, to me, transformative restaurant. Because you could have a hot dog in the bar. It catered to the opera set as well as the very casual artisan set. And it was, to me, if you look at it, kind of the first American brasserie. He actually took Vanessi's, which had an open kitchen, and that was his inspiration. If you look at the open kitchen in that style restaurant, it started at Spago and Stars. Spago was a little different. Stars kind of upped it a little bit. And it was very much of a brasserie with the open kitchen. That really kind of fueled the open kitchen trend that you see. I mean, even 10 years ago, you went to the East Coast and you didn't see open kitchens. And now it's like everyone has it. He is very handsome. And again, he was a brilliant cook. You can't leave that out of the equation. His combinations. The way he used food. There were so many dishes that to me were a revelation. It was the first time I had watermelon and tomatoes and red onions together at that restaurant, which I still remember. It was just a party. Even non-natives viewed the Bay Area sensibilities as inherent to the restaurant. Says Lucchetti,
I think the fact that it was in San Francisco made it so it could be successful. Because San Francisco is probably more democratic at that time than New York was, for instance. You look at the history of San Francisco in general, the whole gold rush thing. The people that made the money and discovered gold, they were a pauper one day and they had tons of money the next day. So I think there was always that more egalitarian tradition in San Francisco. The common denominator was just going to be the good food, and it didn't matter who you were. Everybody had access to this food. That was one of the greatest spots in San Francisco history, says Unterman, because it was just a crossroads. Everyone from every part of society was there. The upper ones, the lower ones, the artists, the poets, the socialites. It was just one of the greatest mixes. You could sit at the bar and have a hot dog. You could be in the little special place and have champagne. Jeremiah was such a flamboyant character. He was completely democratic and completely outrageous and gay, and it just epitomized the society. The freedom of San Francisco.
And everybody came. We counted covers, says Forzheimer. We were doing 180 a night. Then we were doing 230. Then, whoa, we did 350. Then it was back to 230, then, whoa, 410. Then every weekend seemed to just pick up steam. And after a while, we were hitting 500 on the weekends and doing 300 during the week. Just as diners flocked to the dining room, aspiring cooks rushed the kitchen. There were so few places to go in the United States if you were like me, says Forzheimer. If you were educated, hungry, dying to not only cook, but cook something amazing, you could count on one hand the places that would just take you in, partly because of the French training, partly because of the French identity, partly because of how much volume there was and the ability to hire. Stars was a magnet for that kind of thing, for I just want to cook, the way Dan Barber's place is now, for, you know, you've got a farm-to-table bug up your ass. You go to Blue Hill. Can I have a job? And so we had that going on. We had rock stars. It was all celebrities, and there was press in and out. Every dish that went on the menu, you read about it. So people came from everywhere. They wanted to work there. He had the ability to hire. Tower could also, says Forzheimer, be scary. I remember it was salads. It was true of everything. He would comb through your salads. I mean, these salads were big. You'd make 15 of them at a time. He would come through. And he had an eye. And he would go like that. His whole head would turn and he'd go right for one of them, and he would reach into the middle. He had very long, elegant fingers. He'd reach in, and out would come this, you've seen what a bad leaf of lettuce and a bag of lettuce looks like? It would be rotten and kind of droopy. And he would walk up to you and he would take his fingers and he'd put it right in your mouth, pushing up against your lip and say, this one's for you. And the first time he did it, I was, huh? He goes, this one's for you. And I was staring at him. He goes, eat it. And he goes, well, you wanted someone else to eat it, right? Eat it. He shoved it in my mouth. And it doesn't taste good. He was just dead quiet. I saw him do that to many people. And it wasn't just salads. Sometimes it was something else. You put a bad anything out and he would just pick it up. And after a while, he didn't have to say anything. He'd just hold it up and you'd eat it. Not sure I could legally do it anymore, but I'm telling you, it sure made you pick through your salads carefully. You lived in fear of him coming over, and he would just stare. And if he didn't say anything, walked away, that was a good day. He would turn bright red, and he would get very clipped, says Forzheimer. And it would be, you know, what is this? What are you thinking? What are you thinking? That kind of thing. Just sort of a cross between, I'm disappointed in you, and I'm controlling myself so I don't hit you. On the flip side, there was Tower's intimacy with the gods of food, Julia Child, Richard Olney, Elizabeth David, that heightened his aura among the crew. We busted our asses for a week just for the moment at 9:30 when service was winding down, and Tower would come in the kitchen and just kind of hang out, says Forzheimer. Kind of lean over by the grill and start talking about something that he did with Julia Child in France 10 years ago. We'd all kind of slide over, kind of keep an eye on your pans. But he would just talk 10-15 minutes about it. That's why we were all there. Just to hear that story. Because he tells a great story. He tells an amazing story. And he lived bigger than any of us ever could. Remembers another former cook. One night, there is a World Heavyweight Championship boxing thing going on, a pay-per-view, somewhere in town. And Tower comes in with the mayor and the chief of police. They come into the restaurant, and they invite him out for dinner to go see the boxing. So he goes out with them to go see the show. And he comes back at, like, 11:30 at night. Dinner is over. Supper has started. I'm in the pizza station that night, and I'm working late, so I'm in there. And I see him walk in. And he walks into the restaurant and he's an impeccable dresser. He's got the chief of police badge, the six-pointed badge, the San Francisco police badge on his jacket. And he walks into the kitchen and he's wasted. He walks into the kitchen and he just screams out, "Who's the new sheriff in town?" And all the cooks turn around and I remember this guy now because he went far in the San Francisco restaurant scene. He became a general manager. At the time he was a busboy. Really handsome gay kid. "Who's the new sheriff in town?" And he's standing there like this. And the guy is coming out of the kitchen. Just happened to be coming out of the kitchen toward the dining room. And Jeremiah is right there and walks up and goes, "You! You're under arrest!" And he starts walking up to him. And he is like, "What the fuck?" And he starts backing up, backing up. Jeremiah goes, "Freeze! You're under arrest!" He kept saying, "Freeze! You're under arrest!" And the busboy keeps backing up, and he backs up to the hotline. And now, meanwhile, the whole dining room is right here, and they're all, like, looking at JT, and he goes, "You're under arrest!" And he backs him up against the hotline. And he goes, "Now I'm going to frisk you!" It was fabulous. I remember once, it was a late night, and I think people were going to do something, says Forzheimer. And he said, "Are you going?" And I said, "No, I think I'm going home." And he looked at me like, "Why?" And I said, "I'm tired. I want to go to sleep." And he said, "I'm going to sleep when I'm dead." Just very matter of fact. I remember that stuff. I'm 53. It sticks in my head. There's so much that I teach people now. I teach classes. I have a bazillion employees. And a lot of it came right out of Tower. Not that it was an original statement. It was just the way he said it. He was actually living it. Jeremiah's Jeremiah. In 1986, Harper and Row published Tower's first cookbook, Jeremiah Tower's New American Classics, a rectangular tome, modest in heft next to some of today's doorstops, that was dedicated to Elizabeth David, Richard Olney, and the staff of his restaurants. Balboa Cafe and Santa Fe Bar and Grill were fresh enough that they are referenced alongside stars. The book doesn't promote the restaurant so much as it does Tower himself, through stories of grand meals and an aristocratic lifestyle. Photographs depict Tower and friends on a hunt in the countryside, or lunching in a vineyard. The headnotes and chapter introductions shimmer with a depth of knowledge and detail only possible from an author who has spent a lifetime in adoration of food. Compared to McCarty's first cookbook, published 3 years after Tower's, New American Classics truly is American, with recipes for stuffed chilies with black bean sauce, grilled vegetable salad with Texas ham and aioli, and a black and white ice cream soda. It also neatly encapsulates the dichotomy of stars with dishes as high-minded and Eurocentric as sea urchin soufflé and as everyday as a chicken club sandwich, both treated with equal seriousness. Through it all, Tower continued to live big. He made frequent trips to Europe, sometimes with Franz at his side. Before and after Stars opened, the two would often connect with Richard Olney in London, take in a 4-hour wine-soaked lunch, then refresh and get back out to dinner, talk nothing but food the entire time. Richard Olney was Jeremiah's Jeremiah, says Franz. Tower also often brought his crew to New York City, booked a limo for the night, toured restaurants with them. Sous chefs and above at Stars were required to have passports, in case he had a sudden urge to expose them to standard-setting experiences, such as breakfast at the Hôtel du Crillon in Paris. He called these reference points benchmarks.
Yo, we're going to eat some clams.
Stars continued to draw young talent, even from across the country, like Bruce Hill, a young cook who had motorcycled cross-country to San Francisco, wanting in. He got a meeting with Franz, but there was no opening. So he campaigned, returning with stalker regularity, until he happened by the day after Brendan Walsh left to return to New York City, and was hired. Hill was taken by the mix of high society and everyman at Stars. One night that was incredibly memorable was the night that Run DMC and the Beastie Boys came in for dinner, says Hill. They were playing a concert together, so they were at the same table. And I'll never forget that Jeremiah was really cool. He was totally taking care of them. They didn't really understand the food, so he was cooking things that would be more understandable to them. And one of the guys from Run DMC saw some clams on the oyster bar display. There was this oyster bar that had about 6 counter seats, and that was right where the salad guy was. And this guy was like, "Hey man, can you make us some clams?" And Jeremiah says, "Sure, I'll steam you some clams." And so the guy's in the kitchen, watching Jeremiah cooking these clams. And Jeremiah goes, "Okay, they're ready. Go back to your table. I'm going to serve them." And this guy is walking out of the kitchen. He's like, "Yo, we're going to eat some clams." And right as he's walking out, some socialite woman is coming out of the bathroom going back to her seat up in this little area called the club area, which was where all the socialites sat. And that's where all the menus were as well. And I'll never forget the look on her face. It was like the clash of two worlds, the socialite and some rapper from New York. And it was so beautiful. It was incredible. And that's really what Stars was all about. It was a place that attracted all these different people. It was the second coming of Christ, says Mario Batali, who was installed as a sous chef at the Clift Hotel in the mid-1980s. It was the most interesting thing I've ever seen. Jeremiah was a fascinating character and renowned. He was loved by society and cooks. He had created a place where, kind of like La Coupole, kind of like Balthazar later, a place where you could go in a tuxedo or you could go in golf shorts and feel comfortable. The food was serious. It was seriously priced, but it was of the moment and remarkable for its variation. They changed the menu every day. The way they'd do it, they would come in and they'd have 50 pounds of scallops. They'd put it on the main course menu. And tomorrow, if there were 9 pounds of scallops left, they would make scallop ceviche. You just watch them, how they cycled the stuff through. And Mark Franz and David Robbins and Steve Branian and Loretta Keller. They would all have a little meeting at the end of the night to look over their stuff. How much do we have left of this? In addition to being artistic, it was clearly a business that was being run smartly by the people. Not necessarily Jeremiah's business smarts, because he wasn't that smart business-wise, but he was a genius in PR and the best possible frontman. There wasn't a person who didn't love Jeremiah. I'll never forget a lot of things, but one of the things I saw that most impressed me. Paul Bocuse is in there, and they served him prime rib and cauliflower gratin. And I just thought, really? You didn't serve him the black bean cake or something crazy? And at the end of the day, what you realize then is when chefs really want to impress chefs, it's never so much with technique. It's always with product. So he must have gotten the most amazing American beef. and he knew that was going to blow Paul Bocuse away. Vitaly was also drawn to Franz.
"That's all that mattered to me was impressing particularly Mark," says Vitaly. "Mark was the godfather of all my gastronomic ambition. He was just the smartest, goodest guy. He got it. He was fair. He was even. He was passionate. He was a great cook. He was the first guy that was curing his own salami and making his own prosciutto before everyone else started to take credit for it. He was the taciturn but sage leader, and it was great to watch him operate. He was the operator of that restaurant, undervalued historically like you can't possibly imagine. The single most important influence of my life."
Vitaly would park at the Oyster Bar.
"I would sit there for 6 hours, drink a single malt scotch, and watch the whole situation night after night after night. Or I'd sit at the bar. Maybe I was annoying. I thought I was their friend. They would do 750 covers a night. I mean, it was insane how much volume they were doing. And I mean, they were packed at 4, and they were packed at 11:30. Babel, the Tully's New York City hit, opened in 1998, was modeled after Stars. I wanted it to feel comfortable and yet elegant enough that if you wanted to put on a tuxedo, you'd feel comfortable. And a big menu. They had a big menu. They had a lot of stuff.
Some of that stuff. Jeremiah's snapper ceviche with avocado mango salad, marinated red onions and cilantro. Grilled braised sweetbreads with potato gratin, Swiss chard, roast shallots, and pesto. Grilled lamb shank with roast eggplant, roast garlic, and a red bell pepper sauce. The restaurant also, as Tower had done at Chez Panisse, created themed meals, sometimes based on historic menus or events. "We did the dinner that they served on the Titanic," says Forzheimer. "It was very over-the-top things." It all kept Tower front and center in American chefdom. But Tower always felt that his homosexuality kept him from being fully accepted, both among his peers and his clientele. "It has always been a barrier," says Tower. "The social San Francisco, which I had complete entree to because of San Francisco socialite Denise Hale, and they all came to Stars. I was so famous, and they had to be at Stars. So they had to never comment on it. San Francisco society figures couldn't comment on it. But I knew there was still a kind of barrier there that, if I had been straight, wouldn't have existed. More generally, I think there was a lot of confusion how somebody could be so famous and successful and be gay. And that meant my fellow chefs. You know, I think there was, with some, with many, I don't know, a lot of resentment that because I was gay, I shouldn't have been able to achieve. In their books, the rules were that I shouldn't have been able to do what I did." None of this was ever explicitly stated to Tower. "This was all a vibe. I mean, I never made a point about it. I never said I was gay, and I never denied it because it wasn't for me. It had just gotten really not much to do with it. For me, your sexuality is not a political thing as it became with many, many people. So that was just boring. I mean, I'd rather talk about the politics of foie gras than that. But it was definitely a confusing thing for a lot of people, and I knew that, but I just didn't feel, I mean, I didn't, there was nothing to deal with, really. But I knew that there was a fair number of chefs who felt resentful. It just wasn't fair somehow, you know?" At various times, Tower has also claimed that he hated the demands of his fame and success, but now says, "And for the most part, I sort of enjoyed it. I did all my public relations. I'd sit at Zuni's with a glass of champagne in the afternoon and make notes. And every letter or phone call, anything I ever received or Stars received, got a handwritten letter. So there were 15 or 20 a day that I signed and sent off. So Jeremiah Tower was a construct, a business construct. And the Jeremiah Tower who said hello to 350 people a day out of the 1,000 that came through Stars, I mean, you can't do that. You can't do that if you actually think that's who you are. If you are, then you're a little bit crazy. And also, I never read the good reviews. I read only the bad ones, because I knew I couldn't stand it. I knew I was in trouble if I believed my own press. Is there anyone who it wouldn't go to their head? So, the times that I made big mistakes was when I was starting to believe my own press, that I was this superstar who could do anything he wanted. In 1989, a tuxedoed tower appeared in a Dewar's ad campaign, on which the Scotch giant spent $100 million. Tower also opened a smaller restaurant, Speedo 690, in San Francisco. As was the case with other members of the Stanford Court gang, Tower was in perpetual motion, not only around his various properties, but also at charity events, creating a circuit for the top echelon of chefs that found themselves thrust together around the country, serving morsels of signature dishes at tasting stations, then popping into each other's restaurants for the star treatment. Any time when we went to New York, to Jams, or Bud's, or wherever, of course we'd be wined and dined there. And any time Jonathan Waxman came to Stars, he'd be wined and dined, says Vranian. And we were talking Cristal or whatever. I remember an evening where Jeremiah was sitting there and said, "Jonathan, we've got to stop this. We're going to go broke." There'd be no check. Everything was free. It was just hilarious. But it wasn't just chefs coming through, of course. Richard Olney was there. Elizabeth David came through. There's a general belief among many of his peers, including Waxman, that Tower spread himself too thin, that being in other restaurants meant that there was no Tower at Stars. The Stars without Tower's immaculate presence and omnipresent flute of champagne wasn't Stars. Among the places that siphoned his attention were a Stars Cafe, Stars offshoots in Oakville, Palo Alto, Manila, Seattle, and Singapore, and a dream project, Peak Cafe, on the other side of the world in Hong Kong. Franz traces the beginning of the end to the San Francisco earthquake of 1989. The kiss of death was the earthquake. Stopped. Overnight. 30,000 office workers from the federal and state buildings which were all around us, who came for lunch on a daily basis, were gone. Life was never the same. Franz was home when the quake hit. I was pouring myself a beer, sitting down. As I was sitting down, I heard this crash coming from behind me. It was a wave. It was just this wave. But of noise, you know? The world just going like this. And it was the beginning of the Oakland A's and the San Francisco Giants for the World Series. First game of the World Series. I remember standing out on my foyer, looking out over San Francisco, and seeing smoke, thinking, "Oh my God, the world is done." That is what happened. The world just changed. San Francisco doesn't like earthquakes, and nobody comes. Once that happens, they don't come back for a couple of years. It takes them a long time to forget. Really. And what happened was, you know, the Bay Bridge was closed. They all stopped coming. They realized that they had food in Berkeley. And it's never been the same. Ever. San Francisco has not ever been the same. Not that way. Stars held on another decade, then shuttered in 1999. Tower moved to New York City. He wrote a memoir, California Dish, published in 2003. It doesn't hold back, especially about his feelings about Waters. "A lot of people have complained about how he's been," says Franz. "That was a pretty wicked book. It got deep. He burnt many, 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 many bridges. A lot of people can't believe he actually comes back to San Francisco. That's how much they feel about it." Sitting with Alice Waters during our Shea Panisse interview, I ask her about the split with Tower. "It was," she says, "a sad, unfortunate parting, because we certainly had great, great times, but it really fell apart. Like a marriage. Very painful ending. But you know, when I really do think about it, we went our separate ways, and it seems much more of a logical parting because I was much more political. I mean, I was political. He's apolitical. I was an idealist, and he was cynical. And the restaurant sort of had a life bigger than both of us at that point. It had a momentum." "I've interviewed him a couple of times," I say. "It's hard for me to picture him here. It really is. Stars I get, not having ever been there, but knowing all about it." "But you could picture him if you could see him in his 20s, she says. "And somebody that had never been a professional chef and getting into his whites and thinking about, you know, those blinis that his aunt made or whatever it was. Oh, let's do them so that there's butter dripping down off your elbows.
Let's serve it with that. I mean, he was playful in that way, and a little nervous that there was only one meal. You had to have it on, or it didn't work.
When Stars came along, I suggest to Waters, it seems to me like it brought what each of you was fundamentally about into high relief.
I would say that,
agrees Waters.
I think that that's really accurate. We both went on and made what we wanted.
This was my only sit-down with Alice Waters, but that portion of our conversation is the one I can still hear, the one that rang the most true, the least guarded.
What's that doing there?
Sometime during the writing of this book, I recognized that while it's of course desirable to relate history with the authority of one who was there, it can also be dishonest. These stories were told to me, and a thorny theme was the desire of many involved to shore up their respective legacies. One former River Cafe cook, a good friend of mine no less, even told me he dreamed up the chocolate Brooklyn Bridge. There were moments when I felt more like a beleaguered gumshoe than a guy who just wanted to relay the evolution of the American chef, and never more so than when trying to disentangle the Tower Waters double helix. The question is so front of mind that when I imagine Stars, there's one image that floats to mind above all others. It's not the groundbreaking, low-high combination of a burger and glass of Lafitte at the bar, or Tower mingling amongst the people. The chef impresario, ruler of all that he surveyed. It's not the famous photo of him astride a motorcycle purchased the same day he defeated Doyle Moon in a lawsuit, or laughing uproariously with his bar patrons. It's not his doer's ad. I've seen all those things, and yet the image that comes to me is of a handwritten letter, hung on the restaurant's wall, just below the VIP section. It was a letter written to Tower by Waters back in the mid-1970s, praising his talents in very personal terms. The letter lodges in the memory of many. The first interview I conducted for this book was with Jonathan Waxman. I wasn't sure where I was going with it when I asked him if I could bend his ear. We met at the lounge of Batali's Chelsea restaurant, Del Posto, which, as Stars once did, had a piano player when it first opened. Jonathan, whose lack of vanity I find lovable, arrived in checkered chef's pants, a purple Izod polo shirt, and sneakers. We began interviewing, and this, literally, was the first unsolicited thing he said to me. There is a famous incident from when Jeremiah Tower opened up Stars. There is a VIP section at Stars, and he put letters from friends and fans up there. And he put up a letter, a love letter, that Alice Waters had written to him. When he left Chez Panisse, Alice wrote how much she adored having him at Chez Panisse. It was a love poem. I'm not going into the psychological analysis of what she means, but it was a letter that was meant for his eyes only. It should never have been in the public. It should have been an intimate thing, but Jeremiah put it on the wall. I kind of know why he did that. He wanted to flaunt his independence. It was kind of a crazy, wild thing to do. I would have never done it. But in a way, it sort of showed what Jeremiah was all about. It also showed the emotion of what was going on those times. Because everybody knew that it was kind of like Edward Teller in Los Alamos. He was the genesis of making American food what it is about now. That is all because of Jeremiah and Alice. Why did Jonathan mention that letter, I wondered. It wasn't a secret. It's been written about in the San Francisco Chronicle and in Thomas McNamee's book, Alice Waters and Chez Panisse. And those who saw it remember it. There was a letter from her, says Fortzheimer. It was like a love letter up on the wall. And at some point over the course of a year and a half working there, I'd read everything on the walls, but I never asked about it. I knew it was weird that that was there because I knew that they didn't get along, but I guess I was too chicken to ever pull someone aside and say, what's that doing there? He stuck it there as kind of a fuck you, as I recall. Everything else on the wall was the 1983 Schramsberg tasting and menus of the Lusitania. Well, first of all, my comment on that action is, if you'd like to be in the hospitality business, you have to maintain good manners. And if you don't have good manners, you're an asshole. The end, says Clark Wolf. Jeremiah Tower behaved badly in public. Shame on him.
The end. He stopped having a voice for me and a lot of other people when he went to the self-aggrandizing negative. He invited the press, mostly the New York Times, to Chez Panisse hoping for fame and glory. Turns out he is not what they found.